Usually after an introduction, you say thank you, but I'm going to say wow. It's a pleasure for me to be here on the 50th anniversary of the Philadelphia Society. No one believes more strongly than I how important organizations like this are for protecting and regaining our freedoms. Liberty is what made America, America. And if we lose it, we're not going to be the America we grew up in that we want our children and our grandchildren to live in. That brings me to the topic of my talk. It's called Regulation and the Rule of Law. As you heard, I spent most of my life not thinking about such things. But recently, I have become enthusiastically interested. There's nothing that excites me more than the project that I'm working on that I've started with the Hoover Institution and that I'm going to tell you about today. Ronald Reagan's example that you just heard about is an example of a president who believed in the rule of law. He asked the critical question, what's the law? He understood that the Second Amendment of the Constitution gave him the responsibility for effectively administering the law. That's a far cry from some of the things that we see today that I'm going to talk about. The problem goes back a long way. It was in the Bush administration, we heard about signing statements. The president saying, I'm going to sign this into law, but I'm not going to enforce part of it. Well, that idea goes all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, who said very much the same thing about the Alien Sedition Acts when he was inaugurated as president. He said, I'm not going to enforce them. Then they were repealed. So that's an old challenge to the rule of law. The Constitution does not say anything about presidents having the right to pick and choose among the laws they're going to enforce. It says in plain language that he faithfully executes the law. Now, there are exceptions, of course, emerge because there are so many laws and some are so trivial that no one cares whether they get enforced. But now we've gotten to where a president willy-nilly on any given day can decide he's going to change the law, and he does. Where does he get that responsibility, that authority? He doesn't. How did we manage to get there? That was the problem that intrigued me. How can they do these things? And the answer was it has to do with something called standing. So I've been learning something about constitutional law. And I learned from reading Richard Epstein's book that he doesn't really have that authority, but he takes it. And because the standing rules under a decision of the Supreme Court called Frothingham back in the 1920s said that in order to object to these things, you had to show that you were damaged and you had to be an individual who was damaged. It wasn't good enough that you were a state or a city that was damaged. That didn't meet the standard. The standard that the Supreme Court apparently decided in Frothingham had to do with individuals. And we have a case coming up now on parts of the Affordable Care Act, where they managed to find some people who claimed to be damaged and who were able to bring a case. But that hasn't happened with so many of these decisions that the president has made. So that's a problem, and I think a major problem, because if presidents can decide that they're going to change the law, then what does the Constitution mean? Constitution says in Article 3 that Congress can make the rules for the judiciary. I have exchanged emails with Richard Epstein, and maybe somebody in the audience will tell me the answer. I have not been able to get a satisfactory answer as to why we can't change the rules applied to the decision about who has standing. Now, let me give you some examples of the things that have exercised me. There was the Chrysler decision, the decision to simply strip the bondholders of most of their rights and give them to a foreign corporation, Fiat, that promised to produce small cars in the United States. There's, of course, countless things in the Affordable Care Act where we're requiring some to cross-subsidize others. And it's my reading of the Federalist Paper 10 that James Madison thought the Constitution, that he had written a Constitution or helped to write a Constitution which didn't allow that. That is, as I read Federalist 10, it says the government that we've established has the right to provide public goods like roads and foreign policy and defense, but we've tried to arrange things so that they can't redistribute. That is, we tried to arrange things so what he called factions would not arise to positions of power. Factions today we call interest groups. And unfortunately, James Madison was wrong about their ability to rise and redistribute. So I'm interested in the rule of law. And the rule of law, according to a famous U.S. law lawyer, and I quote, "The rule of law at its core requires that government officials and citizens are bound by and act consistent with law. Law must be set forth in advance. It must be prospective. It must be made public. It must be general, be clear, be stable, and certain, and be applied to everyone according to its terms." Now, the last part of that sentence is most important, applied to everyone. And on the Supreme Court, it says equal justice under the law. But much of the regulation that we have violates that idea and that principle. I'll give you some examples. One which falls into my interest in money and banking is too big to fail. Too big to fail, we didn't have too big to fail until the 1970s. Gradually it grew and grew and grew so it incorporated more and more banks and non-banks even. And what does it do? It says if you're beyond a certain size, we're not going to allow you to fail. So that gave those banks a special benefit, a great and important special benefit. They could borrow at rates below the rates that their competitors would have to pay. The result is that back in 1950, the largest banks, the five largest banks in the country, had 10% of the loans. They now have about 50% of the loans. How did they get so big? Well, they had an advantage. And the next size banks didn't have that advantage. So they sold out to the largest banks. They merged. And therefore, the large banks got bigger. And now the problem of too big to fail appears to be big. I testified four times on the Dodd-Frank Act, which incorporates a provision about too big to fail. Just as an aside, a couple months ago, we had some hearings on this legislation. A senator from Massachusetts asked all the witnesses, "Did the Dodd-Frank Act eliminate too big to fail?" The answers, the four witnesses said, "No, no, no, no." Did not. Now, in my testimony, I urged that we have 15% equity capital for large banks. That would eliminate too big to fail, I believe. Why 15%? Because during the years 1929 to 32, the worst period in American banking history, and first some of the worst periods in American history, financial history, no New York bank failed. They didn't fail because they had 15 to 20% equity capital. They were prudent. As a matter of fact, they were so prudent that when President Hoover recognized that banks were being forced to fail because the examiners would go around to the banks, they would examine the banks, they would mark the loans. They didn't know what the market value was, so they marked them at their face value. They looked at the railroad bonds, which mostly the banks held. The railroad bonds were selling way below par. They dumped the bonds on the market and then went to the next bank, and of course, its bonds were now lower, so they closed that bank too and threw its bonds on the market. President Hoover thought that wasn't a very good idea, so he had a meeting in New York with the bankers, and he asked them, can you people, big bankers, come up with $50 million each? That was a lot of money in 1931, 32. Can you come up with $50 million each? And I'm going to start something called the National Credit Council, which was a forerunner of the public RFC. This was going to be Hoover's effort to establish a private solution, and it will buy up the railroad bonds as they get thrown on the market, and that way we won't have all these failures. The bankers said yes, but they put in a proviso. They said, well, if we fail, we want to be able to use our share of the $50 million, the $50 million that we put in, we want to be able to discount that at the Federal Reserve to save ourselves. Federal Reserve said no, and that made it very difficult to find a private solution. So Hoover eventually established the Reconstruction Finance Corporation as a public corporation. Well, that's an aside. The important thing was that they had $50 million each of money that they could put aside in the midst of the worst banking crisis in history. They were very prudent about their lending policy. That's one of the advantages of 15% equity capital, make them prudent and to give the stockholders some leverage over the management to say, what kind of lending business are you doing? So that's an example. Well, an unusual thing happened. I got a call from Secretary Vitter, who said, would you come in and talk to my staff about how we can put that into legislation? So I did, and they incorporated it into what is now the Brown-Vitter bill. Vitter got together with Senator Brown, a liberal Democrat from Ohio, and so it's a bipartisan bill. And it requires 15% equity capital on these banks, which have more than $500 billion in assets. And it says also, and very importantly, that it applies to all their assets, because the banks say, well, many of these assets are not worth 15% equity capital, so we shouldn't have to hold them. We should be able to risk adjust these things. Risk adjustment brings back circumvention, finding ways around the law. I'm very familiar with that, so I decided no. It applies to everything, and if you don't think it's worth holding 15% equity capital, sell it. So that's what's in the law, and the law is in the Senate. I asked Senator Brown in January whether it was going anywhere, and he told me what I feared he would tell me. He said, well, the banks have a lot of clout, political and economic, so it may not be going anywhere. But it illustrates the rule of law. We're going to apply the same law to everybody. And that's very different from my experience some years ago when I gave a talk at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. And the body of the talk was about circumvention of the law in crony capitalism. So I wasn't surprised when the first speaker got up, the council being financed mainly from Wall Street, said, "I'm a lawyer, I work on Wall Street. Who do you think shows them how to circumvent these laws? We do." Now, I wasn't surprised that he said that because that was the burden of my talk. What surprised me was how enthusiastic and proud he was of the fact that Congress passes laws and our job is to find out how we don't have to follow them. Great. So I want to do something about this. There are a lot of things. I mentioned Chrysler. The Affordable Care Act is full of cross subsidies. We're going to make these people pay for those people. All that violates the equal protection of the laws, as I understand it. So what can we do about that? Well, I spend part of my life at Hoover Institution these days, and I have worked with some of the lawyers at the Stanford Law School, and we have a program. Ken Scott, who's an emeritus professor at Stanford, Charlie Calamiris, who's a professor of economics, finance at Columbia, and I have a project, fairly extensive project, called Regulation and the Rule of Law. So I'm going to tell you about what we're starting to do. We think this is a long project. We don't know exactly how it's going to end up, but we're going to do what we can to see that it ends up as best we can make it. One part has to do with the law. Fortunately, Stanford has on its faculty Mike McConnell, who was a circuit court judge in the federal system, is now head of the Stanford Constitutional Law Project, and he's working with us. And we're going to start out looking at the question about standing. That is, what can we do about changing the rules of standing so that we don't get these results, that we don't get, or at least where we make actionable in the courts, challenge to the responsibility of the president to faithfully execute the law. And we're going to have some papers, including one by Richard Epstein, on the Administrative Procedures Act. The Administrative Procedures Act was written in 1946 to regulate the New Deal Agency. We've gone way beyond where the New Deal agencies were in terms of regulations, and there hasn't been any revision to the Administrative Procedures Act. So we're going to have people look at the question about how should that be changed to try to rein in some of the things that the regulatory agencies do. That's one branch of this project, and an interesting branch, and it explains why I've started to study constitutional law, because I want to be able to understand what the lawyers are telling me. I have learned in dealing with lawyers that words don't always mean what they say. For example, when the Constitution says the president shall faithfully execute the law and doesn't give him any right to change the law, well, that's just a fact that can easily be overlooked by a whole series of case law. So I'm trying to learn some of these things. The other part of our project is, I should say first that the first thing that we did in our project was try to decide what is it that we can do, where can we start to work. You know, the problem goes through every agency, as far as I can tell, in the government, that there are extensions which are far beyond the rule of law. The National Labor Relations Board, the Environmental Protection Administration, just name them and there probably is some exception. So where do you start? Well, since we all have some interest in economics and finance, we're going to start with too big to fail, because that's a big one. And as I told you before, we haven't solved that problem. I mean, what the Dodd-Frank Act does is it puts the Secretary of the Treasury in charge of a committee that decides on whether we're going to bail out banks, whether we're going to use taxpayer money to support a failing bank. Now, how does that problem arise? I think I told you what my solution would be. Let me tell you what the existing facts were in 2008. Some of these banks had as little as 1 or 2% equity capital, so they didn't care about the risk that they took. The rest of their required capital was made up of bonds, but they insured the bonds. So the result was they didn't care. The risk wasn't on their shoulder or on their capital. It was on the insurance company's capital. So they weren't cautious about the risk that they took, and that certainly was a factor in why not too many of them looked through the risk that they were taking when they were taking all these mortgages that the government was pushing actively on them. So we want to change that, and we're going to have discussion of both North America, the United States, and Europe. What can we do to make the banks something like what banks are supposed to be, that is, safety being one of the major factors in their organization. So that's our project, and we have been fortunately supported by some foundations, and this problem extends across the world. In India, you have corruption, crony capitalism, regulation. Wherever you see regulation, you see crony capitalism and corruption. So we don't believe that you can end regulation. Every economist learns very early that there are differences between private and social cost. What we want to do is try to get regulation which is much less subject to corruption and crony capitalism. Usually, I get asked, what do I think is the chance that any of this work is going to find its use and become law? And I've been involved with problems of this kind for a very long time. So my answer is that you can never be totally optimistic that research will end up in law. What I learned from Milton Friedman, especially, was this idea, that if you don't do the work, you have no chance. If you do the work, don't expect anything to happen until there's a crisis. When there's a crisis, you have a better idea, and that idea has a chance of being used. So here are some examples. One was the draft. Milton worked hard with the military, some of the congressional leaders, to end the draft at the start of the Nixon administration. The crisis was the Vietnam War. People were burning their draft cards, young men. They were going to Canada. The war was very unpopular. The liberal program was, we'll have a a lottery. If you win the lottery, you get to serve your country. Boy, an unpopular war. So at that point, the Walter Oi, who recently died, a blind Japanese-American, had done a study of the demand for military service as part of this project, and he showed that there would be a price, a reasonable price, within reasonable budget cost, at which they could raise a volunteer army. And Friedman used that in convincing the military. I don't think there's anybody in the military now who would want to go back to anything but the all-volunteer army. That's one example. There are many others, and I won't dwell on them. I just want to say that I believe that there will be other crises, and that if we are prepared for them with ideas that work, that have been argued out, that have been discussed, not necessarily accepted, that we have a chance of improving the way in which these things work. So, as is always the case with these things, the circumstances are terrible, but not impossible, and we have to make them better. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Meltzer. We're a few minutes ahead of schedule, and Professor Meltzer has agreed to take one or two questions if anybody would like to do so. We don't have a microphone, so I'm going to ask you, Lester, to start, because I see you're eager. And just call out the question from there. If other people don't hear it, I'll repeat it. So Lester O'Shea.
You mentioned that none of the New York banks say they get adequate equity over 50%. Is that required
by the city bank? No. The question was, I said that the New York banks in 1929-32 had at least 15% equity capital. And the question is, did they have that because it was mandated, or why did they have it? And the answer is, they had it because they were prudent bankers, and they voluntarily chose to be prudent. And before there was regulation, you know, years ago, my old friend George Benston, who was a very good banking economist, came up to me one day and he said, "Alan, what's the difference between banks in the 1920s and banks in the 1950s? And I said, "I don't have a clue." He said, "Well, in the 1920s, they had big windows with gold letters, said banks, paid in surplus and capital. In the 1950s, all gone. Member FDIC.
Alan, The Economist magazine recently came up with an index of cronyism. The country that came number one in cronyism is the same country that appears number one in economic freedom in the index of Fraser Institute and the Heritage Foundation. Have you read that index, and don't we have a problem then to defend the morality of free enterprise when we have those things?
Yes, that's in The Economist you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yes, I read the index. I'm not sure I agree with the index, but I do believe that cronyism, corruption are rampant, and I believe that they have a lot to do with the fact that, for example, the index that the Wall Street Journal publishes with Heritage, the United States has fallen quite a bit from where it was at the top of the list or near the top of the list to somewhere down around 17th these days. Pardon? 12th, and I think that's not unlike the fact. You know, what is regulation? Regulation is just a way of making separate taxes for specific purposes. I mean, it's cost applied to corporations, and Congress often thinks about regulation, and this president certainly thinks about regulation all the time in exactly that way. How can we punish them for the evils that they do?
won't eliminating the restrictions on standing, although reduce the president's power, remove the last obstacle to judicial tyranny. Now liberals will be able to sue any conservative president or governor on any policy whatsoever. So aren't you worried about that trade-off?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Well, it will open the door. It will remove the last obstacle to judicial tyranny. It will mean that liberal groups can sue any conservative governor or president on any policy, whether they have standing or not. So we'll replace presidential lawlessness with Supreme Court lawlessness, and I don't think that's a gain.
Yeah, I have no answer to that. I mean, somebody is going to have to administer the law, and so far, the courts are the place where that gets done. If you have a better suggestion as to where it should be done, I'd be happy to hear it. The present system is not a good one, because there is no restriction, or there doesn't seem to be any effective restriction on what the president is able to do. And that means that's not a good thing. The only solution I have is to give the problem over to the judiciary. You know, there's always room for corruption, and maybe that will be what will happen. But I don't have another solution, and if you do, I'd be happy to hear it.
Thank you for your talk. What do you think of the argument that a bank that is too big to fail is too big to exist, and that this should be addressed through antitrust regulation, keeping banks small enough that they can fail so that they don't become a constant magnet for government intervention?
I think we had a banking system. Did you all hear that question? Why don't we use antitrust instead of to prevent too big to fail? I've always believed that the market system takes care of problems like that. After all, I gave you the example that back in 1950, the largest banks had 50% of the loans that they've grown because of regulation. If we reverse what happened, they'll shrink. That is, if they're not too big to fail, they'll be like other banks. The rule of law will apply to them just as it applies to the banks that are smaller than they are, and they will work out their problems of not, they'll have to pay higher interest rates, market interest rates, and therefore things which they do now will not be attractive to them in their new circumstance. So that will gradually work its way down. We don't need to use a blunderbuss like antitrust division to solve that problem. Markets will take care of it.
Last one, please.
What's your evaluation of Bernanke and your guess about Yellen?
Yeah, those are separate questions. I think Bernanke did what was very necessary in 2008 to prevent a collapse of the payment system. Let me expand on that for a minute. The reason we got there, there were many reasons why we ended up in that crisis. The housing policy of the federal government was certainly very important. But what caused the immediate problem were two things. One, the Fed had bailed out Bear Stearns. That was a mistake. It should have let Bear Stearns fail. That would have led many of the bankers to take corrective action, would have been in a much better place in 6 months later. Second, when Lehman was allowed to fail, it wasn't the failure of Lehman that caused the crisis. It was the failure of Lehman against the background of a very weak banking system, so that lenders, borrowers couldn't know who was going to be next. The sense, you know, follow the rule, save yourself if you can, sauf qui peut. That was the problem. So what we want to do, what I want to do, what my group wants to do, is get them to where if there's a failure, it's an isolated failure. It doesn't pull down the whole payment system. Bernanke, under the circumstances as they existed, did what was mostly the right thing. That is, he didn't allow the crisis to become a collapse of the payment system when the economy would grind to a halt. The mistake he made was to continue that after it no longer made sense, so that by the end of the period, when he leaves office, there's $2.5 trillion of idle reserves on the balance sheets of the banks, and there's more than $2 trillion in cash and near cash on the balance sheets of corporations. What in the name of heaven can we expect to happen if we add another $1 billion a year to that total? Nothing. Nothing. Did it work? In my opinion, no, it did not. The unemployment rate has come down, but the main reason the unemployment rate has come down is a problem that should worry us, and that is, for a long time, older men have been leaving the labor force for decades. So the fact that they leave the labor force is not surprising or new. What's new and surprising is that 18 to 34-year-olds are leaving the labor force in large numbers. Why is that? Well, because for many of them, they get discouraged, but they also have the advantage that they can collect food stamps and housing allowances and unemployment compensation for long periods of time. They can work in the underground economy. They can do the things that they do in France, that is, where they have permanently 10% unemployment rates and going up. That's what we're training people to do here. That is, now, in my view, that's a terrible idea. Some of the Democrats, liberals, have said, well, isn't that great? People can live without working. I don't think that's great. I think it's terrible. I think, you know, our ancestors came to this country, most of them unskilled. They took low-wage jobs. They learned skills. They moved up. What's happened in Singapore, in Hong Kong, in China? The Chinese took people out of agriculture, put them into manufacturing, gave them skills. Their wages have gone up by 20, 30, 40%. That's how people make progress. They save, and they make sure that their children are getting more education than they did. The Koreans have done that in America. They've done it in Korea. The Hispanics, many of the Hispanics are doing it here. That's how America became America. It didn't do it from the welfare state. It did it by work, education, training, skills, productivity improvement.
Yellen was the second
part.
Oh,
Yellen.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. I got carried away. Yellen is a very smart, very able labor economist. She's not a monetary economist, so she's going to be dependent on the staff much more than Bernanke was, much more than Alan Greenspan was, much more than Paul Volcker was. The staff will, for the most part, want to continue this policy for a long time, and she said as much in her recent speech here in Chicago. What worries me most about that problem is they don't have a way out. They have $2.5 trillion. So when I ask my friends, and I have a few, at the Federal Reserve, what are they going to do when the $2.5 trillion starts to come out? It's going to be a tsunami rolling over the whole world. What are they going to do about that? Well, they say, we'll raise interest rates. And so, of course, the next question is, how high? Well, they say, as high as we need to. You know, you want to bet on that? I don't. I mean, there's things called the Congress, the labor unions, the business community, the general public will say, you're killing the economy once rates get above 5 or 6%. So I don't think they have a program to deal with that problem. Now, we've already seen the beginnings of it just in the announcement effects and the reductions in the rate at which they were adding. It made a big difference to countries like Turkey, Brazil, South Africa, big developing countries. Those are problems which we're going to face in the next couple of years. Finally, let me say, categorically, I do not know of any example anywhere in the world at any time when you had large deficits financed by money that didn't end up in inflation. Not a single case. Perhaps this will be the first, but let me describe to you what we've been doing, what to go back to Bernanke. Paul Volcker financed something like 10%, 9 to 10% of the large Reagan deficits. Ben Bernanke financed 43% of the enormous, much larger Obama deficits. 43%. There has never, I repeat, never been an example of large deficits financed by money growth that didn't end up in inflation.
Thank you very much. Well done. Thank you. Thank you. Cover very much. On your behalf,